Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and editor Simon Lamb today is deputy editor Lee Boyce. And coming up, as MPs quiz energy bosses on what they're doing to help customers with growing debt, we explain what makes up your bill and give some practical advice to reduce it. Also today, a World War II nurse has had her pension frozen at a pittance because she moved down under. Are you saving enough for retirement? The Great British Rail Sale trolling commuters, and less Netflix, more chill. Everyone's favourite euphemism gets the cold shoulder from subscribers. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
eToro is a social network.
No, eToro is an investment platform.
Fly me to the moon.
It's both. That's social investing. In other words, it's where millions of people invest in stocks, share ideas, strategies, and beyond. eToro, the power of social investing.
In other words,
download eToro today from the App Store or Google Play. Your capital is at risk.
But first, whose responsibility is it anyway to help families struggling under the weight of rising energy costs? Bosses from E.ON, EDF, Scottish Power and British gas owner Centrica were quizzed by MPs on what they were doing to support customers after complaints that suppliers were forcing people onto more expensive variable tariffs. In response, the chief execs called on the government to offer more support, with bills expected to rise by another £600 this October. Simon, just firstly, how bad is this going to get, and what can and should be done about it? Whose responsibility?
Ultimately, it is people's responsibility to pay for their energy bills. But we have now reached a point where energy bills have gone up by so much that we're talking about the state having to step in and the government having to step in with some form of assistance, which we have seen something of already. When Rishi Sunak announced his, what I heard someone describe the other day as a buy now, pay later deal on energy, whereby people are going to get some money off their energy bills, but they're going to pay that back over the next 4 years. The question is now whether that's enough. The price cap has gone up substantially already. It went up by about 50% at the start of April. And it is tipped to rise again in October. And it's in October that the expectation is that things are going to get really bad. I think people are definitely going to struggle to pay their energy bills over the course of this spring and summer. And they're going to be having some much bigger bills landing on their doormat or in their inboxes, as most people's bills do nowadays. But they're going to have the benefit of using less energy. Now, we'll come on to some of the stuff around what you should do about your bills and this question of whether you should take advantage of that using less energy and pay less over summer, or whether you're just creating yourself an even bigger problem down the line a bit later when we're talking about this in the podcast. But once we get to that October hike, just at the point when people start to use more energy, they use more gas because they're going to be heating their homes more because the weather's getting colder. They're going to be using more electricity because it's darker. And that is the point when there's expected to be this big crunch, and the energy bosses warned about potentially 40% of households ending up in energy poverty, which is astonishing. They're expecting a big, big rise in the number of people unable to pay their bills. And they think that the government needs to step in and do something. So,
like, just what are they asking for?
I mean, literally, I think that the issue here is the government going to just have to either give people money or take money off their energy bills? One idea that was floated the other day was some form of system whereby poorer households are given money off their energy bills and richer households pay for that. I don't know how palatable that is going to be in reality, to be perfectly honest. I think that we would see quite a big pushback against that when the plans were actually sketched out properly. I think in theory, this idea of, okay, there's some people really suffering here, we need to help them out, can you pay a little bit extra to help them out? Sounds noble. I think that the richer people, the wealthier people, the people in the bigger houses are going to be asked to do that at a time when they are already being walloped with massive energy bills. And to put some context on that, the price cap, the energy price cap, jumped 54% to just under £2,000 a year in April. It's expected to go up another £600 in October. That's what analysts at Cornwall Insights suggest. But that's for the average household. If you live in a bigger house or a less energy efficient house or something like that, you're going to be paying much more. I don't live in a particularly big house. It's bigger than average, but it's not particularly big. It is, however, a 1960s house that has not really been updated since then. We have plans to do that in the future, but we're not able to do it. We're not going to do it now. We're not able to do it now. And at which point we'll make it more energy efficient. My energy bills are going to be about £4,000 a year or potentially even higher. So that puts a bit of context on the numbers that, you know, some people are going to be facing who are in those bigger houses and are more able to pay. And would I be happy to pay a bit more to help people out? Yeah, I would be happy to pay a little bit more to help people out. But then we're already paying a little bit more on our bills to do various other things, such as the green levy and stuff like that, which we'll come into later. So I think that there is a real problem here, but dealing with it is going to cost a huge amount of money. I mean, we're not talking furlough size sums of money, but we're talking very big sums of money. And ultimately, you know, it kind of boils down to the government just giving money to energy companies if they do that.
Always a tricky one, I would suggest. Lee, look, we've got energy rebates coming, apparently council tax money coming. Not enough, is it? Energy firms do offer help in terms of certain grants, etc., but again, not enough. Simon's been talking about bills. So breaking down the bills, is there anything in there that we can take out? I mean, we talked about VAT as an idea, cutting VAT. That was pooh-poohed by the government, and that actually is a pretty small amount that can go. Green levies, that's a big amount in there. And also the social, we do pay quite a lot already in terms of, you know, social schemes and that sort of thing within our bills. How is a bill broken down, and therefore, are there any parts we can take out?
Well, Georgie, first of all, I'll say that the figure that two in five households might find themselves in fuel poverty by October because of rising prices is a very worrying.
What do you mean fuel poverty? What is the definition of that, Lee?
It's basically that if your fuel bills get so high that you get then taken under the poverty line, essentially, you're just basically in poverty because your energy bills are too high, you know, and the choice of heating your home, you know, is not an option for everyone all the time, which I think is a very sad state of affairs, because a lot of those households are likely to be vulnerable and they're likely to contain children. And I think that's incredibly sad. And that is the kind of reality that we're looking at it in October. There's already lots of people that have been pushed into fuel poverty anyway. You think about 22 million people who are out of a fixed contract already that are paying this higher bill that came in at the start of the month. There's going to be more fixed contracts running out between now and October. There's a lot of people that are on prepayment meters that already have a slightly higher cap anyway. It's a very worrying, troubling scenario. And I think that there's already a lot of people that are struggling and panicking now. Come October, this is going to be even more extrapolating, I think, even more concerning. And you know, the big question is what else and what more can be done? Now, as we pointed out before, we're now going to be coming in between, coming into summer months, you know, and it feels a little bit like it's a bit of a kind of a relaxation, and perhaps this will drop out of the news agenda a little bit. But then by the time sort of September rolls around and we're coming up to the new price cap, you know, this is going to be really probably one of the most biggest concerns for households. And that suggests that more needs to be done than what's currently on offer. Now, you're talking about how is a bill broken down. The big one is the wholesale price. That really makes up pretty much more than half of the bill. And that takes, it's basically gone up so much for reasons that we already kind of know. And it's just become very expensive. And that's why a lot of the smaller energy firms went kaput, because they didn't forward buy wholesale gas. So that's how they managed to offer sort of slightly lower prices, getting big customer numbers, but they weren't able to keep up. They couldn't keep up with low fixed rate tariffs that they've been on offer when wholesale prices started to rise. That makes up a huge amount of the bill. Next biggest thing is the network costs, and that's gone up quite a bit, and that makes up almost 20% of your bill. The reason why that's gone up quite a lot is because of the firms that have gone bust. It's sort of sucked up in terms of the cap, because the big energy companies that are taking this on get to claim back some costs, and this essentially gets added onto bills. But without that supplier of last resort, there'd be a lot of, I mean, I don't even know what would happen if that wasn't in there. It'd be in all sorts of carnage. And so some of these bigger energy firms have taken on millions of customers, and that comes at a cost, and it comes at an administrative cost, the cost of getting people set up on systems and getting bills out and all of that kind of thing. And they're able to take some of that on. That network cost is about infrastructure as well. It's about the pylons, it's about the gas pipelines, it's about keeping all of that, you know, working, essentially. So that takes up another bit. And then another one that's quite big is the policy costs. That's actually fallen as a proportion of the bill. It's still gone up, but it's fallen as a proportion of the bill. And these are sort of like grants and things that are on offer to perhaps insulate your home better, and things like the warm homes discount that people can claim. That all gets sucked up into there. And then everything else, I mean, it's quite small fry when you look at that compared to the wholesale and the network costs. You know, there's things like, we were talking about the green levy and whether that should be scrapped. Well, it's kind of difficult when you've got things like smart meters being rolled out and that kind of thing.
Isn't there a fairer way of doing it though, Lee? The point about the green levy is that everyone, even the poorest households, have to pay it. Can't we sort of add it into income tax? Eek! But you know what I mean.
It gets messy, Georgie, doesn't it?
It always does.
It always does. And it's messy. And, you know, we're talking about this drive to net zero and all of that kind of thing. And now, you know, noble intention.
The smart meter thing, has that been a good spend of money? Like,
you know, in an absolute nutshell, no.
Right, okay.
You know, it's been an expensive rollout. The two benefits of having a smart meter is being able to, you know, hopefully be able to keep track on what you're spending and sending those accurate readings, because, you know, I get bugged by my energy firm quite frequently to go and take meter readings out. I've got a gas meter reader and an electric one outside, you know, and I think about doing it all the time, and then other things get in the way, you know. So it does stamp down on that, and it is important, especially at the moment. You remember a few weeks ago we had this smart meter meter reading day, and everyone sort of like crashed websites and whatever, like trying to input what it was that their usage was on the 31st of March. Well, you know, with a smart meter, technically you wouldn't need to do that. But some people like them and some people don't. And that's just the very Marmite. And that is a fact of life. So, you know, without going too far into smart meter bashing, it's not really the thing that is pushing up bills at the moment. It is the wholesale cost, and it is the network cost, and what can be done about that. And then you talk about, well, you know, could you cut VAT? Could you scrap VAT whatsoever? And I think at the moment VAT makes up something like 20 quid of a bill, you know, in terms of the price cap, you know, it's 20 quid.
So we talked about this earlier this year before Rishi's great £200 off your energy bills and you can pay it back deal, and £150 off your council tax for band A to D, which is claimed to give 80% of households in England that money off, which I find quite hard to believe that 80% are in band A to D. But I mean, if the government says it's true, then maybe in this instance it's true. I was going to say, if the government says it's true, it must be true, but then I stopped myself. Which does illustrate problems with the council tax system, because D is the middle one, right? And if 80% are in A to D, then you can see there's definitely a problem with the system, can't you? But when we talked about this earlier in the year, there were some options put forward to help households, and there were some figures put on it. And these figures were put on by Cornwall Insight, right? So this was ahead of the price cap going up, but I believe they had taken into account what they thought the price cap was going to go up by, and that they were pretty much bang on that figure. So a VAT windfall adjustment, potential saving on annual bills, £30. Cut VAT, £90 a year. Defer failed supplier cost recovery, £90 a year. Move green levies to general taxation, £160 a year. Suspend green levies, £160 a year. Defer network costs, £330 a year. And then there was the two big ones. Loans to energy suppliers, £500 per year. Direct support to customers, £500 per year. And those were just if they went, well, if they could give some support. Well, we got direct support for customers and it was worth £200 a year and you're going to have to pay it back. So the question is do they go down the route of some of those smaller ones that are going to help people out, or the big ones there, which is obviously direct support to customers involves either just taking money off your energy bills or giving people money. And how much money do we give people? If we give everyone £500, it's going to cost quite a lot. And the other one is the loans to energy suppliers, which is quite interesting. And that involved effectively giving energy suppliers money, potentially in some form of loan system so that it was paid back. And the idea would be that it would smooth the prices. So the government would give energy suppliers payments when wholesale gas prices rose above a certain level in return for them not passing those costs onto customers. So therefore it would soften the hikes and smooth prices. And the kicker would be that energy firms would somehow return money to the government when prices traded below a certain level. That was actually the one that got sort of the policy wonks and the people in the energy industry most interested and excited as a sort of, well, this could actually work kind of thing.
I remember talking about it a few months ago. What happened?
Well, I don't know. It just got sort of shelved, put on the back burner, didn't it? Because Rishi said you're going to have £200 off and £150 off your council tax and you can pay the £200 back.
That, by the way? I don't think you're entitled, are you, Simon?
I'm above band D, I'm afraid.
Right. Okay. Lee, have you got yours?
I haven't seen anything yet.
No, me neither. I'm just checking. Sorry, Simon, carry on.
Yeah, so the question is are they going to do something now, spring, summer, or are they going to leave it until autumn? I mean, the hope is that the price of gas goes down and electricity, which is also an issue. And we did see a massive spike in gas prices after Russia's invasion of the Ukraine. And then actually we did see them sink substantially through April, but they are still running at a pretty elevated level, the kind of level that we were worrying about before the Ukraine crisis. I guess the big hope is that they come down again. And you do have to take into account that there's a lot of trading that goes on with commodities, gas prices, electricity, oil, etc. And hopefully that has exacerbated the spike. And if the heat comes out of it, it could mean that actually they do fall faster than is expected. Mm. I do think we have to work on this scenario that we're going to see another £600 bump in the average price cap energy bill come October and work towards that. And if it's better than that, then that's great. If it's worse than that, then we've obviously got a bigger problem.
Indeed. Look, Lee, Simon said at the start, yes, our responsibility to pay our bills. So before we end this, practical advice for us?
Sure. And actually, before I move on as well, I should say I misread the chart. VAT is more like £90, not £20. I got me.
I thought 60, so we're all over the place, Lee. You know? But compared to thousands and thousands.
Somewhere in that ballpark.
Yeah, it's roughly.
I think the number one thing to do is if you're someone that is worrying about soaring bills and your ability to pay them, it's to get in contact with your energy supplier. They should be able to give you practical advice. They should be able to tell you what grants are available, and they should be able to tell you essentially, you know, things that you can do to ensure that, you know, you're not going to fall into a massive energy debt, which is what, you know, energy firms don't want that to happen. Unfortunately, that probably is going to happen. I mean, we've had the forecast from the chief exec of E.ON saying basically expects debts for customers to rise 50% to £800 million. That's quite big, isn't it? That's quite a big leap. So you want to get in touch with them. And actually, again, from this meeting earlier in the week, the chief exec of Scottish Power said it received 8,000 calls in the week before about customers worried about paying their bills. So, you know, these call centre staff at energy firms should be well versed in giving you advice as to what to do. It's really difficult to give much more advice than that. I mean, I'm running out of energy talking about energy if I'm being honest, George. It's tricky, you know, without patronising people. Mm. We had this conversation before about turning your thermostat down and all that kind of stuff. We're well past that. You know, there's people that just can't afford to pay the bills no matter what they do. So it's about getting that advice and finding out what help is available to you, essentially. And I think that's really the only piece of advice I could really give. And, you know, make sure you're posting accurate bills, as Simon said. You don't want to be stung with excessive charges because you haven't read your meter correctly. I mean, indeed, that'd be quite annoying. And that's about it. I mean, what else can you do?
If you do get a shock bill that you can't pay, don't bury your head in the sand, though.
Indeed.
That's the really important thing. This is the important thing with anybody who ends up in financial difficulty, has debts that they're struggling to manage or anything like that. You need to tackle it head on. Speak to someone about it. Speak to someone you trust and you feel that you can be open with. The old adage of a problem shared. Mm. Go seek help professionally. Speak to the person you owe the money to, i.e. the energy company in this instance. They can help put you on a plan to pay it back on a more manageable level. Speak to Citizens Advice if you're really struggling, if you've got problems. Don't just bury your head in the sand. And also, if you think your bills are wrong, challenge them. And do not, and I repeat, do not get bullied by energy companies that still do this disgraceful thing of failing to fix people's wrong bills while threatening them with debt collectors. We have had countless cases of this in recent weeks. Crane on the Case this week was about it. A girl whose energy bill was quite clearly completely wrong, and EDF were meant to be sorting it out. And while they're meant to be sorting it out, they're threatening her with debt collectors. And so she's worried that the debt collectors are going to come around. It's going to ruin her credit rating, going to ruin her financial life, etc. So she feels that she should just pay up. It's bullying, okay? She had an £879 bill for 37 days of energy.
Wow.
Clearly, you can't use £879 worth of energy in 37 days. This happened to me years ago with British Gas. Going back, 14 years, I think this was, with British Gas. Do you know what? The system, it's not got any better. These energy companies are an absolute disgrace when they do this.
Yeah.
And we've got another case that we're investigating, that Helen's looking at, where someone moved house last spring, were given a final bill by Bulb and told that they were £1,600 in credit and Bulb would pay the money back. Hmm. Sent them a final bill, said the bill had been corrected, everything was sorted, gave them the money back. Lo and behold, January this year, more than 6 months after they move, they get a letter from Bulb. They're not even a Bulb customer anymore. They don't live at the house. They've moved. Bulb says, yeah, we've recalculated your bills. And we've discovered that you now owe us £1,900.
Oh, wow. So,
how do you swing around like that?
4,000-ish, 3,000
out. £3,600 swing, right?
Wow, okay. That's a big
going
swing.
Going back to 2018. Now, there are rules against back billing. Energy companies are
sounds
not allowed
dodgy,
to back bill
doesn't it, Simon?
By more than 12 months. And they've not explained why there's been this sudden change around. They've not explained where this money's come,
they need
come
the money.
From. This customer has been dealing with that Bulb, which obviously the taxpayer has effectively bailed out Bulb because it was considered too big to fail. Since that point in January, trying to get an answer out of them as to, excuse me, what's going on here? Can you please explain this? How do I owe you the money? Why are you trying to backbill me when you look at Ofgem's website and it very clearly says you can't backbill more than 12 months and so on? Nothing. Just keeps getting told you owe us the money. They've offered them to put them on a 12-month repayment plan, still threatening debt collectors. Still threatening debt collectors. Another one we're looking into. And there will be countless cases like this. And the energy company bosses were given a grilling this week because there's a suspicion that they're also trying to pull in more money from people on their direct debits. They're upping their direct debits to get money in so that they can sit on the cash in order to help their businesses. And I think that the one thing that needs to come out of this is a massive cleanup of the energy market. And energy companies need to get their act together. And the first thing that they can start doing, if anybody from an energy company is listening to this, okay, is start dealing with this bullying, threatening debt collector nonsense that they are doing, because that puts households under huge amounts of stress and means that people are paying bills that they genuinely do not owe, and that is unacceptable.
Hear, hear, Simon. That's the end of part one.
And now I'm joined for our weekly look at what's been going on the markets and what's coming up next week by Sam North of eToro. Hello, Sam.
Hi, Simon. How are you?
I'm good, thank you very much. So what have we seen this week on the markets?
Well, despite a shortened week here in the UK due to the bank holiday, it's still been an intriguing one. While the most traded equity market in the world, the S&P 500, is pretty much where it opened the week, that doesn't tell the full story. Two main things stick out to me, one being the really bad earnings from Netflix, which sent their share price crashing lower. It was actually the first time in over a decade they've lost subscribers quarter on quarter. Also, the other thing, we're starting to see central banks, and in the US in particular, price in 50 basis point rate hikes over the next three meetings. So global central banks are having their hands forced by this rising inflation that we're seeing, and it looks as though they're going to have to act more aggressively than we might have thought a few weeks back.
And what do we have to look forward to in the week ahead?
Well, next week is massive from an earnings point of view. So it'd be interesting to see whether we have other companies that struggle like Netflix or outperform and shock the market like actually Tesla did this week. So earnings on the whole have actually been okay. But next week, we've got Microsoft, Google, Visa, Facebook, Apple, Amazon. It's going to be a blockbuster week from a scheduled data point of view. We've also got some more inflationary readings out of Europe and US. We've also got US GDP from quarter one and some policy announcements from the Bank of Japan, which will be worth keeping a watch on considering the yen has weakened to levels not seen for many years. So they may even intervene, which will be interesting. Definitely a week to keep an eye on.
Sounds like one. Sounds like a busy one. Sounds like you're going to be a busy man this time next week when you have to tell us what happened.
Absolutely. Fingers crossed it's going to be okay.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Sam. Goodbye.
Thank you very much, Simon.
Welcome back. A 100-year-old woman who served as a nurse in the Second World War is one of nearly 500,000 elderly expats affected by a government policy critics are calling outrageously cruel and morally wrong. So Patricia Coulthard is missing out on thousands of pounds a year in state pension because she moved to Australia back in the 1990s, where payments to elderly Britons are currently frozen. She gets just 46 quid a week in state pension. Lee, what's going on here?
I think this is a really interesting story, Georgie, and I've always thought this is one of these personal finance issues that deserves attention from time to time, because, you know, there are a lot of elderly pensioners who move overseas for whatever reason, perhaps to be closer to family that have emigrated, such as in the case of Patricia Coulthard here, who's moved to Australia because that's where her children went and she wanted to be close to them. And people go around the world, you know, and that's just a fact of life, you know, and there might be for all sorts of reasons. Now, there's a system out there that means if you move to some countries that has an agreement with the government, you'll get your state pension uplifted in line with the annual increase, which happened earlier in the month. America, for example, and the majority of Europe are basically covered by this. But then it leaves some areas popular for people to go and move to, such as Australia, such as Canada, where there's hundreds of thousands in this boat, where state pension has been frozen. You know, and in the case of Patricia Coulthard here, who, you know, worked in Britain, she would have paid her contributions, and that's the argument of people that are in this position. You know, they deserve it. They deserve it to be uplifted, and it makes no sense as to why it's frozen. And you can understand the argument. And I asked Tanya Jeffries, who wrote this story, to sort of come up with a figure of what, because my first question was, well, how much would it cost to uplift pensions for everyone across the world? Nearly half a million people affected by this. And the figure is £600 million. Now, that is disputed somewhat. I should say £600 million a year. That is disputed somewhat. It doesn't actually sound like an awful lot of money to me. But the big thing is, and this is where I think the nub is for this, and this is where government has failed to act in all the time since the 80s that this has been going on, is I think that because they're not in this country spending the money, it's almost like, well, why would we uplift it? You know, they've chosen to go and live abroad. They know the rules. But that doesn't make it any fairer on people. And there's lots of campaigns and things suggesting that they should be unfrozen, but would it happen? I doubt it. I really doubt it. I can't see it happening, and this system looks like it will remain in place. And, you know, whether pressure grows to sort of unfreeze these pensions is, especially in countries sort of such as Australia and Canada, you think it would make sense. And there's a whole list of countries that we've got in this story that are affected by this, but that I would suggest that they're the two big ones. But then we have deals in place with a country like Philippines. So if you go and move to the Philippines, you'll get your state pension uplifted. And if you went and moved abroad in the 90s, you might be getting 40, 50, 60 quid compared to state pension. It should be somewhere probably more like 150 to 180 quid, depending on if you're on basic state pension or the higher rate. So it's a difficult problem to solve. There's 500,000 grumpy pensioners out there worldwide that are unhappy that their pensions are frozen, the majority of which would have known the rules when they moved. Mm. But as I say, does that make it fair? If you spent years making your contributions and you expect that money in retirement to help you have a better retirement, you know, especially someone like Patricia Coulthard, who served her country, you know, you feel like she's done her bit and she deserves that money. I find it very difficult for me to say, yeah, she deserves to have that pension frozen because she chose to go and move to Australia. Her children chose to move to Australia and she decided that, you know, she loves her children and she wanted to be close to them. But I guess there's enough information out there. And when you go to retire abroad or
The point is, it's unfair, like whether the system is, you know, it is as it is, but it seems a bit, you know, I've worked hard.
You look at the list of the problems and the solutions and the things that the government has on its plate, especially at the moment, and you think, well, should we prioritise? It is such a tricky one, Georgia. There's so many pros and cons to it all, and I think it would take a very brave government to come out and make the decision to change this system.
Yeah,
at least make it again. I always think, Georgia, and I always think this about pensions, especially state pension. When we were talking about, you know, what ended up being a really poor uplift this year, when you compare it to inflation of 3.1% or whatever it was, and now we've got inflation at 7%. I always thought that middle ground of, you know, when it was announced, it was kind of like, it was because of the wage growth that skewed the figures. So it meant an 8% rise looked pretty chunky. But I always said, just meet in the middle. I don't understand why there isn't a bit of meeting in the middle in this kind of scenario, and how complicated it would be. So there was some sort of scenario in which people kind of had a minimum amount that they get paid, you know, £100 or something, £40. Just feels like in this time now.
What can you do with that?
What are you going to do with that? I mean, Australia is an expensive place to live anyway. Yeah. So that probably gets you, I don't know, not much.
Not much.
It almost feels a bit pointless. So, you know, it would take a pension minister to come in, deal with that problem and look at it and tackle it with a kind of, well, maybe we can't just uplift everyone to this amount, but perhaps anyone that is under £100, maybe we should make that the minimum amount. Something along those lines. I mean, this is just me coming up with suggestions in the back of a fag packet.
Yeah.
You know, it would take a little bit more thinking space than that. But you see what I mean? It's just a problem that I think just gets quashed all the time and no one ever takes hold of it, and it could have a solution potentially.
Just to go a little bit off topic, Simon, so at least raise something that I get asked quite a lot whenever I'm talking about things like pensions or the situation with the energy crisis is, yeah, but you know, everybody has a vested interest. The government's got lots of things to do, lots of priorities. Who gets priority? Everybody wants some money. So, you know, can you help everyone? Can you help everyone?
No, you can't help everyone. It's impossible to help everyone to the degree that everybody would like to be helped. But you can play fairly. And I think in this instance, we're not playing fair. I think that we aren't paying these pensioners increases that really they should be due. The list of countries that you can get them in and the list of countries that you can't get them in is completely bonkers. If we just said anybody who moves overseas doesn't get the pension uprated, that would be unfair in my eyes, but would be a fairer system than saying, well, if you move to this country here but not to that country there, that's not a fair system. And there's a false argument about this that, well, you know, people aren't, you know, they've moved abroad. And they're off there spending their pension money in other countries. So why should we give them more of it? And it's like, yes, but actually, if you look really at pensioners, not meaning to be impolite here, but they are an economic drag, not an economic benefit. Actually, by moving abroad and putting a burden on other people's health services and other people's services and so on, and collecting their pension, even though they're spending their pension there, they're actually saving us money, I think. So I do think it's unfair. Yeah. You can't help everyone. It sounds like a lot of money. In the grand scheme of things, it isn't in actually a huge amount of money. And with every year that passes, it just seems that this is just a little bit more unfair.
All right, we're going to stick with retirement because more research this week telling us how totally screwed we are in retirement because we are not saving enough. Bad luck, particularly if you are about 35-year-old woman on a low income. There was actually some good news, though, this week in that the number of people who are now auto-enrolled and saving for their future has gone up, but it's not enough and we're all going to die poor and miserable. Lee?
I don't even know how to reply to that, Georgie. That was that was very doom-mongery.
I don't know if you got the same press releases that I got during that sort of when the announcement came out about the fact that more people are auto-enrolled, but millions. Yes, I know we could all save more, absolutely. But isn't that something to celebrate? Some of the press releases were like, we're doomed. I was just like, oh my God, guys, can we just, you know, ease the pressure a little bit? Some of these articles, and then you say, the one that we're talking about now is a sort of interviewed 2,000 people with about 70 million people in this country. So look, where were we really at, Lee? How screwed are we, and are these press releases just being a little bit over the top to get us to write about these stories, or actually they got a really good point there? Because all evidence at the moment suggests it's getting better. Don't get me wrong, we're not there, but you know, come on.
2,000 people.
Bit Rocky back massaging here for everyone. We're doing all right, no?
2,000 people is a very big representative for a poll. I would say 2,000 is genuinely fairly accurate reflection. Depending.
Lee, I'm reading a book called, I can't say it because it's a swear word, but it's all about using statistics. 2,000 when you're talking about millions of people. I get it, but it depends on which 2,000 people are you talking to. The people who answer pension questions are probably the people who engaged in it. Anyway, whatever.
Let's not go down.
Screwed? Okay. Yeah,
I agree with you. I wholeheartedly agree with you. I think there was actually some good pockets of news from what we've seen about pensions this week. And the fact that 4 in 5 workers now have a pension compared to 40-odd% just 10 years ago is pretty impressive. And that's over public and private pensions. I think that's quite impressive. That's a big uplift in people that are saving into a pension. And I would go as far as arguing that auto-enrollment has been a very good thing. I think it's been something that has been a success. Actually, if I remember rightly, it was kind of based off an Australian system where they did auto-enrollment and it had been successful out there. And I think it's successful in a way that, you know, to be opted in and you have to make yourself opt out. I think that's very good behavioral economics in the way that it kind of, you start taking it away or you opt out and you realize that actually if you did tuck a bit of money away and you see what happens if you're invested in the stock market with your default pension fund probably is that it will be of a benefit for you. And then you could go down the whole road of, well, is auto enrollment and private pension going to replace the state pension one day? And that's a whole argument for a podcast that could run into about a million hours. But I think there is some good news that people are saving for retirement. The bad news, however, there is a couple of bits of bad news to that, is that are people saving enough? Are people just putting in the bare minimum and thinking that that's it, they're done? But it's very difficult if you're taking your first job or you're age between 18 and 30. There's a lot of things expensive, and things are getting more expensive, that sort of take precedent of that. Maybe saving for a house, maybe you've got children.
Paying your energy bills.
And that's the thing, you know, are people going to opt out, playing devil's advocate here? But, you know, people might go, actually, I'm just going to have to forfeit, being in auto-enrolled pension. I'm just going to have to opt out because I need that extra X amount of cash. And people that perhaps have got in a savings habit or got in an investing habit, you know, they might say, I'm tucking away this amount of money at the moment, but I might have to half that to survive the cost of living crisis. So there's all of that going on. And actually this research by the Pensions and Lifetime Savings Association, which is not a very sexually named association, is it? It doesn't sound that great, Pensions and Lifetime Savings Association. But, you know, it comes up with an interesting statistic here that basically a quarter of people who are paying into a workplace pension worried that they're not saving enough to retire. And actually, when you the best thing you can do on a rainy afternoon, Georgie, is go and have a look at a pensions calculator. Look at what you're saving in, where that forward forecast might take you, and how much that might get you in retirement, whatever retirement might look like by the time you know, you get older. You know, so if you're in your 20s or 30s, like pension age, you know, it's heading higher. But to have a moderate income as a couple, they've got the figure here as £30,600 a year. So that's what you want your pot to be able to pay out to you when you hit retirement age. And that also would include your state pension, whatever that might look like in the future. But you want to go onto one of those calculators, see what you're putting in at the moment, seeing what it does. There's some workplaces that will not only match what you put into your pension, they'll double it. You know, sometimes that depends on how long you've worked there. Sometimes it just depends on how generous the company is. But it is an important thing to think about. And I think a lot of people don't think about it until it's not too late, because it's never too late, but they don't think about it. It's down the list of financial priorities, which I totally understand. And we've had this argument before. But if you can nudge it up by a percent, you can nudge it up by just, you know, a little bit more money, that soon accumulates, that soon compounds. And you should hopefully, your future self will thank you for it. And it comes out of your pay packet, and sometimes you don't even really, I mean, you do notice it at the moment, because of the cost of living crisis. But, you know, the argument is there that the earlier you can start and get a grip of this and save your pension, save for your retirement, the better. But that, there's no one size fits all, as we always say, Georgie, and depends on your circumstances. And there's so many other priorities out there. I can totally understand how it gets left behind. And that is why there's been press releases this week that are a bit doom and gloom.
See, that I've got a few issues. I no issue at all with what you've just said. I'm a big pension fan. I like to talk about pensions. I like to encourage people to save into them. I do. What bothers me about this is, I don't know about you, Lee, but if someone wants me to do something, smashing me around the head and telling me that I'm doomed is not the way to get me inspired to do it. It will get me to bury my head in the sand even further. So that's just my point about the I get it, because it creates a better headline and therefore people's research gets into the newspapers. I understand that. But I also, again, I go back to the who you're questioning. There's probably even if you're saving quite a lot into your pension, if someone were to ask me, are you saving enough? Oh God, probably not. You know, probably not. But I'm saving a fair amount into my pension, right? And then the other thing is, it really depends on who you ask as to how much you're really going to need. I was interviewing a financial advisor who was like, basically, if you don't have £500,000 by the time you're 50, you're screwed. And I was like, all right, well, that's probably most people then are totally stuffed. It's just so hard, because no one gives people pure numbers. It's so difficult to understand pure numbers. I get that. But it's just, is there a better way that we can get people inspired to save and not just smack them around the head and tell them how badly they're doing all the time?
I think there is merit in what you're saying, Georgie. I totally
understand.
Lee. Thanks. Yeah. Actually, sometimes like the numbers like £500,000 by the time you're 50. I mean, that just sounds like bonkers to like the average person.
Yeah.
The average worker would just be like, what on earth does that mean? How on earth am I going to save up £500,000 pot? That sounds absolutely crazy. And that's why I'm saying it's good to go off and research, look at what you're putting in, looking if you can extend the numbers a little bit. And you're right, maybe there should be some more younger person focused pensions research, in which we can look at, you know, what 18 to 25 year olds are there, or under 30s, you know, what is their attitude to pension saving? You know, am I saving enough for retirement? I think the answer would always be no. I don't think I'm ever saving enough for anything. You know, I could be saving,
yeah, exactly,
huge amounts, like absolute massive amounts, and I'd probably say, well, I could be saving a bit more, you know. And that's the thing sometimes, I think it's a bit arbitrary to say this is. It's just impossible to everyone has individual circumstances. Really hard to sort of focus down. I think sometimes these pieces of research, when they start giving you a minimum, moderate and comfortable retirement lifestyle and what that might entail, helps bring it a little bit to life. You know, if you don't have X amount of money at X age, you know, you're unlikely to be able to afford all of these things. But again, I find that difficult to look at the age of, you know, 34, and thinking, you know, what am I old enough to forget retirement going to look like in 33 years time or whatever it's going to be? You know, who knows? I'm saving as much money as I can possibly save at the moment out of my way. It's a very tax efficient, great way to save. It's great to see that pot building up over years. I love getting the forecast and the performance letter come through once a year. I quite regularly engage with my pension. I log in probably once a month, maybe once every couple of months. I diversified a little bit out of just the default fund because of what I do for a living, and I'm engaged with it because we're immersed in it. But there's a lot of people that aren't whatsoever. And that can also account for self-employed as well. You know, you start talking about SIPs and people just... It's hard. It's very, very hard to convince people to save more into a pension, to have a pension, and to think about what their life is going to look like in their 60s, 70s, 80s and beyond.
Simon?
All right, here you go. I'll have a crack at what you wanted. Here's a few things.
Okay.
Firstly, if you start early, it really does pay off. Due to the magic of compounding, if you save £100 a month and you get a 5% return on that, okay, so you're not going to save it, you're going to invest it, but you invest your pension. If you get an average 5% return and you do it for 30 years, you'll have £83,000 roughly at the end of that period. Now, if you just do an extra 10 years, so if you do it for 40 years instead, you'll end up with £152,000. So that's why you start early. That's why you start in your early 20s when you start working. That extra 10 years makes a huge difference, okay?
Right. But if you're 30 or 40, obviously we can't go back in time, Simon.
No, you can't go back in time. But you know what? Start now. The best time to plant a tree is 20 years ago. The second best time to plant a tree is now. That's the old saying, isn't it? Also, you're going to need £20,800, according to the PLSA, as an individual for your comfortable retirement. Ouch. Lot of money, because if you work out how much you're going to need for that, multiplied out by if you did it as a 4%, you know, withdrawal rate on your pension and so on, there's loads and loads and loads of money. But there is a crucial thing: the state pension is worth about £8,500 a year, so that's going to get you quite a bit of the way towards that comfortable amount. Okay, so that may, all of a sudden that figure starts to look a lot better. You've only got to bridge a £12,000 gap, not a whole £20,000 gap. And finally, if you're a basic rate taxpayer and you want to get £100 into your pension, it'll only cost you about 44 quid. And if I said to you, if you give me 44 quid, I'll turn it into 100, you'd probably say, that sounds like quite a good deal. I'll take that. Okay, so...
Yeah, but it's like an extreme marshmallow test because you've got a lot of time.
Extreme marshmallow. But you know what? Once you start getting that money out, you'll forget about it. You won't notice it. And the benefits here are tax relief, which to a basic rate taxpayer bumps up what you put in by 25%. And the fact that it's quite likely that if you're employed, your employer will match your contributions. So if your employer will match your contributions and you can get that basic rate tax relief, then you can turn roughly £44 into £100. Those are some positive messages around pension. The other one is that, as Lee said, we've got loads more people putting money into a pension. Yes, their pensions are not going to be as good as the generation before them who benefited from final salary schemes, or the lucky people who are still benefiting from defined benefit pensions now. But you know what? That doesn't mean you shouldn't try.
Yeah. So. That's what I want to hear. That's all I wanted to hear, Simon. Thank you very much. Right. From pensions to something that's got you a little bit hot under the collar, Simon. The Great British Rail sale is on. So from the 25th of April for a month, 1 million train tickets are on offer for a whopping 50% off. Great news in the face of a cost of living crisis. Eat out to help out Mark II with trains and less eating on the trains. Anyway, Simon, however, is less convinced by this. Simon, I'll ask Lee first. Lee, what is this? Give us the basics and then Simon can tell us why he's not that happy about it.
What this is, Georgie, is Grant Shapps dancing. Is Grant Shapps dancing in front of some destinations around Britain, flogging train tickets in quite a bizarre fashion? It is a load of round tickets that have gone on sale for 50% off. The crucial thing being they're off peak. The crucial thing really being they're off peak. And it's kind
of not going to help with your commuting costs, are they?
It's not going to help with your commuting costs, and it is a bit of a kick in the teeth, if you ask me, for us hard-pressed commuters, right? So can I just quickly...
You have to do anything for it? Do you have to, like, put in a special code, or can you just go... When you go to the ticket machine, it just comes out... You're the lucky winner.
You got a hunt on a special website that might give you inspiration as to where you might want to go and what tickets are available, and all of that kind of stuff. But the criticism has been that there's not many very exciting ticket discounts and very tricky. Right. You know, people that go from London to Manchester or London to Birmingham or London to Edinburgh, they're expensive train fares quite a lot of the time, and they're doubly so if you are doing it at the last minute. You know, you have to plan quite well in advance to get right. some of these better price tickets. But, you know, in terms of commuters, right, I'm back in the office 3 days a week, been back in the office for 3 days a week for quite a bit of it. And I have to buy daily tickets. I have to buy daily return tickets with the tube attached because there's no other cheaper alternative. And the price I'm paying for those 3 days is pretty much on par with my annual season ticket that I had before the pandemic, which when I was going in 5 days a week. So they brought in this flexi rail system where you could get 8 tickets that could be used over 28 days. It works out more expensive than me because I need to add the tube on. You know, it just makes no sense. And I think a lot of commuters feel the same way. In the same breath this week, again, we've had a load more ministers pushing back about come back to the office. We need more people coming back to the office. Well, the biggest barrier, you know, I live in a commuter belt, so does Simon.
Yeah.
There's millions of people that commute into London. Their office is based in London and they're not happy paying 1-2 day tickets because it's so extortionate compared to what they were paying for weekly, monthly or annual season tickets before. And personally speaking, I think instead of targeting this kind of, you're talking about the cost of living crisis, what people are going to go for a little jolly somewhere to beat the cost of living crisis, it's very unlikely that people are going to use these for practical purposes.
Yeah, it's people who really need it. It's not going to...
It's going to be for tourism purposes. That's basically what is being billed as and angled at. I would have much rather have seen some sort of discount system where I'd get a rail card, commuter rail card, I'd get a discount on, I don't know, 5 returns to London a month, you know, a third off. Or something like that, and then the rest I just pay for whack. But at least if I'm getting some sort of discount, it just feels.
You could have written this article, Lee. You.
I could have. Oh, Georgie.
Irate about it.
Honestly, I could record an 8-hour podcast about the state of the train system in this country.
It's shambolic, Lee. I was in Spain recently having a chat about this with someone, and I said, "Yeah, for me to get into work in the morning, it cost me €40 to get from the bottom of Spain." To Madrid was €4, he was paying. That's 10 times. Are they massaging our feet? I mean, are we getting leather armchairs on the train? I was like, no, you're probably lucky if you sat next to the toilet with probably a bike wheel in your crotch. I mean, Simon, what's the state of the system?
Well, I think that what we should say is that the Great British Rail Sale, and let's call it the Great British Rail Sale because that's what the government's calling it, it is unprecedented. It's the first of its kind, and it is helping with the cost of living crisis. To quote the government is listening to people's concerns about rising costs and is taking action worth more than £22 billion in 2022 to 23 alone, which includes support with the cost of energy bills and to help to ensure people keep more of their money. Offering half-price rail tickets is one of the ways the government is further supporting families with the cost of living. It's not really, though, is
it? No,
because actually the support with the cost of living is for the journeys that you have to make, so that you have to go to work, you have to commute. What it's doing is flogging cheap tickets to people for entirely discretionary travel that they don't need to make.
For PR reasons.
It's very difficult to square that with helping in the cost of living crisis. However much Grant Shapps pops up and does a Zelensky in his hoodie trying to tell us about it.
Yeah.
I'm not sure whether he actually read the articles mocking Macron for trying to do the same thing, but bravo for doing that. Just to put this into context, okay, we all choose where we live and we all choose where we work, right? Okay, and we bear responsibility for that. However, I do think that the rail system in this country is completely broken. The one place where it isn't broken is if you can travel whenever you want. If you are entirely footloose about your travel, train tickets are actually quite cheap. if you can travel on a Tuesday morning or a Thursday afternoon or whatever. Unfortunately, if you have to, where it's broken is if you need to get from one place to another place at a specific time, i.e. in the morning during the week, you might be traveling a long distance, or you have to come back in the evening, or you have to go buy a train ticket that day, or you need to do that thing that people do occasionally where they have to go on a Friday and come back on a Sunday. You know, those people with jobs who have to go to work every day of the week, right? Then it is extortionate. And the problem there is it's then cheaper to either fly, which is completely insane, or much cheaper to drive, which is what most people do. And we're trying to stop people driving because it's bad for the environment and it's bad for air quality. Public transport is seen as a greater good. So we need to make the public transport cheaper. Okay. Going back to the whole, you can travel the length of Spain for hardly any money. You can do it in France, you can do it in Italy, and so on and so on. The other problem is with commuter fares. And commuter fares are unbelievably expensive. Now, this is true across a lot of the country. It is especially true with London. And this isn't to be London-centric. London has a lot of people living there and an awful lot more people who go there to work every day. And I'm going to give my example here, right? My train journey into St. Pancras takes 27 minutes and costs £28 a day return. When I was living in London, the tube to work took 34 minutes and it cost £5.80.
Yeah.
Right? That is a completely nuts system. That within the boundaries of Transport for London, you can take a much longer journey in terms of time, for example. It's obviously not in terms of distance, and it costs you that much, much lower price. Whereas all of the people doing the same thing coming into London is costing them a huge amount. Why should we care about those people? Why should we do something about this? Well, because it's an economic benefit. They're not coming into London to work every day for fun. They're doing it because it's an economic benefit. It's a major city, and it has got to the point now where these fares are just unbelievably expensive, even with a season ticket, right?
And also, the people who can afford to live in London can afford a bit more, no?
Yeah, a weekly ticket would be £108, a monthly one would be £414, an annual one £4,300. That doesn't include the tube, right? So just the train fare element. And to put that in context, for a basic rate taxpayer, if you're paying £4,300 a year for your commute, you need to earn £6,300 in order to do it. If you are on a £50,000 salary, which is a very good salary, then you will be paying 12% of your annual earnings just to go to work. That is more than 1 month's work every year that you do just to get to work. I don't think that that's a sensible system. Other people might disagree with me. We've got lots of readers who say, yeah, well, loads of people don't get trains to work and more people drive. So just give some people some money off driving and stuff like that. I don't know. Look, I just think that this is a completely insane system. If you're a higher rate taxpayer to pay that £4,300, you would have to earn £7,400, right? Even if you were someone earning 75 grand a year, you'd still be spending an entire month paying to just get to work. And at a time when we are trying to encourage people to get back into the office, it seems to me that, and we have a cost of living crisis going on, it seems to me that the real thing we would need to do is to help commuters. Instead, we saw rail fares go up 3.8% at the start of March, and then the government brings out this ridiculous promotion where it's mugging it up that it's helping people with the cost of living crisis. If they'd have just said, we're going to sell you some cheap rail fares, go to the seaside, have a nice time, it would be great if you want to travel on a Tuesday, I'd have had no problem with this whatsoever. It's the fact that they mugged up this whole helping with the cost of living crisis nonsense. That's the thing that winds me up. That's the thing that winds all those people sat on a train smarting from their extortionately priced ticket on Tuesday morning after a glorious Easter bank holiday weekend when they saw Grant Chapps' grinning face telling them about how he was helping them out. And I'm going to stop there because nobody wants to hear any more of this.
I don't know, I was quite enjoying that, actually. But I was slightly distracted because I had never checked how much an annual season ticket would be from where I am. I think I'm about 36 minutes, a little bit more than you there, Simon. £5,776. Marvellous. Right, finally, have we spent too much time at home over the last... Here's maybe a benefit, you know, of going back into work. And we've done Netflix, haven't we? What else is there to do? So much so that this week $50 billion was wiped off the value of the streaming service after it revealed a sharp drop in subscribers and warned millions more are set to quit. So Lee, you wanted to talk about this. Why is this interesting to you?
Netflix completed it, mate. Yeah, it's. I think we've reached. I think we've reached peak Netflix, Georgie, and I think that's been reflected in the share price and what's been going on. The reason why I just wanted to briefly mention it is that I think that it's really interesting at the moment what's happening in the States with some of these really sort of popular brands that have been long invested in, and we've seen growth in. Now we're starting to see actually the bubble starting to deflate a little bit, and Netflix is definitely one of those that I would hold up to this. And the reason why I think that it's struggling, and I'm only going to talk about this in a kind of quick UK version of this, is that A, the competition has just grown absolutely astronomically. So whereas Netflix was a bit of a novelty before because it was easy to get on your smart TV, it was easy to get onto your smartphone and tablets, it now has others that are battling it too. And I think namely the number one to that is Disney Plus. And I think a lot of people have switched over to Disney Plus over Netflix because it has a stronger back catalogue. I actually think there's better things, better things to watch on it. And people in a cost of living crisis at the moment don't want to be paying for numerous subscriptions. I mean, personally speaking, I have Disney, I have Now TV, and I have Amazon. That's a lot of TV. And
not Netflix.
I haven't. I cancelled it.
Oh, okay. You are one of these.
Nothing really to watch on it anymore. So, and I haven't been tempted to reactivate it. Prices have gone up. And the thing is with Disney Plus and with Now TV especially, is that there's quite often discounts. There's quite often ways to get it for cheaper to entice you in. And if you're like me, I like to cancel stuff when I'm getting new stuff. So, you know, I think there's been a bit of juggling going on and people trying to sort of go, well, One month I might have Netflix, 1 month I might have Disney Plus, and then just sort of alternate it. So then when you go back to the streaming service, it's really fresh. Mm. But in a cost of living crisis, that might not happen. I'm about to cancel Now TV. I've got a couple of episodes to watch of one last thing I've got, and that'll be gone.
What's
and I'll
that,
be
Lou?
Just winning time, the right. start of the LA, the rise of the LA Lakers dynasty.
I was really hoping it was like a really rubbish kind of like,
I've been really enjoying
Love Island type thing. Okay. But,
and then the other thing about competition is that BBC iPlayer, ITV Hub, Channel 4, Channel 5, they all have much better, sleeker apps now to go and watch TV. We have got so much content.
Yeah.
It is unbelievable. And that battle is just getting stronger and stronger. So I think it struggled in that aspect. And I think the other thing that's quite interesting from sort of Broken Notes and what people are saying is that essentially Netflix doesn't really have any other revenue streams, you know, whereas like Amazon Prime, I mean, Amazon Prime is just an add-on to what is the biggest shop on planet Earth.
Yeah.
Disney Plus is just an add-on to what is one of the biggest entertainment empires ever built. And what other revenue streams does Netflix really have? It's almost like a case of having all its eggs in one basket. And if the content isn't solid enough, there's not enough to watch on there. If prices are rising and people start to think they've had enough, and they're going to exit in a kind of mass exodus. And they're thinking that a couple more million might leave before the end of the year. And I really, really do think that the Netflix thing, the Disney Plus thing has been a big part of that. I think it really has sapped a lot out of Netflix. And as you say, you know, pandemic coming up to summer now, people just probably want to be out a bit more rather than just doing Netflix and chill or whatever it is the kids say.
Yeah. I don't think Netflix and chill involves Netflix.
Yeah, okay, we won't
get into that. Right, Simon, ever so briefly, are we just subscriptioned out now? Have we reached peak subscription? There's no, I mean, Lee's just mentioning they're the ones with sort of series and videos, but then if you throw in things like your Sky Sports, your BTs, your all of this stuff, I've only got a certain amount of time in the day. And most of that spent, to be fair, scrolling through, finding something to actually watch. You know, that is my entertainment. Because by the time I actually find something, it's bedtime. I'm done.
Yeah, I guess there's the discovery element maybe that they could work on and helping people find stuff that they actually want to watch. The great thing about subscription businesses is that people take out subscriptions and then they very rarely cancel them and they continue to pay them forever and ever and ever in a day. But some people do cancel them. And the surprise was with Netflix that not just had its growth stalled, but actually it was losing subscribers now. And that's a really worrying thing for investors. The interesting thing about some of these companies, Netflix, Peloton, I mean, Facebook shares have absolutely tanked, but that's a slightly different issue, is that people got so excited about these businesses 2 years ago, the world had changed, the new normal and everything like that. And they got overexcited. The share price has absolutely rocketed. And since then, in recent times they've tanked. It is over-exuberance, over-optimism. Does it mean they're bad businesses? Not necessarily, but you do need to look at each of them on their merits. And one of the greatest pieces of analysis I've heard on the Netflix scenario and why it's possibly not a great investment is from Stephen Yu, who's the fund manager of Blue Whale Fund. And he said the problem with Netflix is it's like the football industry. So you've seen a huge amount of money go into it and it's all gone to the players or the agents and the managers. The football clubs themselves, despite all of the money going into it, all of this broadcast money, all of the sponsorship money, all this stuff sloshing around, they're not great businesses. And because they're having to hand over, they have to just keep handing over more and more and more money to attract the players. Similar thing with Netflix. This is the cost of content. They have to keep paying up for the content. They just have to keep building up the content. The content is expensive. Production is expensive. And the money flooding into it is just flooding back out. And that's why and it's very difficult to suddenly turn that around and to start ratcheting up how profitable the business is going to be. And that's why I think maybe Netflix isn't a great investment case.
You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. If you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon?
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney and you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all podcasts past and join in the debate and read the comments.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.
eToro is a social network.
No, eToro is an investment platform. Fly me
to the moon. It's both. That's social investing. In other words, it's where millions of people invest in stocks, share ideas, strategies, and beyond. eToro, the power of social investing. In other words, download eToro today from the App Store or Google Play. Your capital is at risk.